Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
It's The Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. J.D. Bunk, a Sailor's Forefar, Blake Murphy. This Insider is brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit DonValleyNorthLexus.com. It's Arden's Welling, Blue Jays columnist, co-host of the At the Letters podcast, and dirt expert. Is the dirt blend everything you hoped it would be so far this season, buddy? Like, I haven't talked to you in a while.
Yeah, maybe that's why the Jays weren't hitting. Have we thought about it? Yeah. Is it the clay?
I mean, you're the one. Yeah, the clay blend, the seven herbs and spices, the dirt that you love so much. Maybe you'd think that maybe Vladdy bouncing it off that dirt every single day that he's at home, that's maybe what's causing the issues for him.
How long until we're going to start holding some of these groundskeepers accountable? 100%. I mean, if you were like that at your job, you would be held accountable. Come on.
That's Blake.
JD is not held accountable for anything with his job.
No, if I was, I wouldn't be here. But yeah, we go over to our resident excuse maker, Blake Murphy, for more thoughts on the dirt. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, they got all the wrong clay in the right side of the batter's box, and that's why they've struggled at home. They got to get that Salem Field clay up here, that Dunedin clay up here. Speaking of jobs, though, Arden, you're normally Blue Jays columnist, co-host at the Letters podcast, but this past weekend, a couple turns, and I know you've done this before, so it's not completely new for you. But how was being the color analyst next to Ben Wagner on the weekend?
Oh, it was awesome, man. I love whenever I get the opportunity to do that. Like you said, I've done it a few times now, and it's just wicked. You know, Ben's great to work with, obviously, like best in the business, so that makes it pretty easy because I don't have to do that much heavy lifting. Like he's so good at describing the play and letting fans who are listening on the radio know what's going on and bringing them into the game and making them feel like they're there at the ballpark, that I can just kind of sit back and, you know, shoot the breeze about baseball, which is probably what I would be doing anyway if there wasn't a microphone in front of my face. So it is awesome to get that opportunity. I love doing it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to hear you on there. And obviously, Ben Nicholson-Smith, our pal Caleb Joseph. I like the – obviously, I'm sure all of you guys would like that to be like a semi-regular thing. But I kind of like the rotating, get a couple different voices, get a couple different perspectives. In terms of excuse-making, though – and
I was TV. Like, I don't know how you did. So I watched TV.
I was out in the country on the weekend visiting family. So I was doing the full – like, I got like six innings of one of those games on the – on the radio. I think it was the Sunday game. So in terms of excuse making, though, you know, it could be the clay at home. It could be, hey, this team can't hit when Arden's doing color commentary. That could be the thing here as well. You're not on color commentary last night. They get the bats going with eight runs. What did you see differently from them last night other than just, well, balls found spots? Because the process, you know, to me looked a little better, but they still went 2 for 150 with runners in scoring position. Still a lot of guys stranded on base early in that game that could have been wasted opportunities. Just what were your thoughts on the eight-run outburst and if something like that can be carried forward into a big series with the Angels?
Yeah, isn't it hilarious to like drag up the box score from last night and see, oh, they were 2 for 14 as far as the scoring position again and left 12 on base. But look, that if you have those numbers, that means you're creating a lot of opportunities. So that speaks to the process that you mentioned. I mean, look, I just saw a really good approach against Jordan Hicks. I saw some really good swing decisions. I saw some hustle early in the game as well from guys like, you know, Teoscar Hernandez and Bo Bichette beating out ground balls and running hard out of the box. Like, those are the things you want to keep seeing when a team is struggling offensively like the Blue Jays are. Like, you want to see those process indicators. You want to see players continuing to take a strong, disciplined approach to the plate. You want to see that hustle. Like, you want to see guys still trying to find ways to win even if the ball isn't dropping. And then that was the other thing that I saw, was I saw a lot of hard contact finally drop in. The Blue Jays have had some trouble with that this year. There's been a lot of hard contact that's gone for outs, and you're seeing things like Matt Chapman barrel a ball for a single. You're seeing the Alejandro Kirk double. Those are things that, you know, I have believed this whole month while the Blue Jays have struggled, that they are going to continue to turn because of that process. And I've been wrong repeatedly every day. Like 25 days into this month, I've been wrong 24 times. Yeah. So it was nice to be wrong once.
Yeah, but you get it right. You get, as soon as you get, yeah, I was gonna say, but that was your, that was the true Arden that just leaked out there. It's like, I was wrong once. It's like, yep, that's, no, that's how you actually see it.
That was okay,
yeah, you know, that was 100%. So yeah, man, I agree. Like, hey, we're all, it's tough with baseball because you can see a guy have a bad at bat, and when the team is hitting like this, it's like a lot of approach talk, and you go like bad approach, bad approach, bad approach. And I really do think that has been the case for the Stars, but that hasn't been the way for me anyways to the guys that you mentioned. Like, Kirk looks great. I feel a high degree of confidence in him at the dish right now. Same. Chapman has frustrated the hell out of me with some of these strikeouts early in the season, especially the ones that he was keeping the bat on his shoulder on. But right now it looks like that's a guy who's coming around. And yes, like, I always kind of make fun of people with the whole BABIP thing. I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. And the hard hit contact when they're like, oh, hard outs. I'm like, I don't really care. Was it in play or not? But no, Chapman looks like someone who's starting to round into form, who's getting a little bit more comfortable at the plate. The other guys, though, like Vladdy felt like a relief. I felt great about him. But the Teoscar thing is starting to concern me a bit. Lourdes Gurriel, we already know what the book is on him, which is he's going to have a hot month. Like, eventually he's going to have a hot month where he absolutely rakes and we go, this is the experience. I'm used to the lows, I'm used to the highs. But what are you seeing with Teoscar Hernandez right now? Because, like, I feel like he's been a little shielded by the narrative of Vladdy and the narrative of the entire team. But, like, this guy was supposed to be the, hey, I'm going to fix it when I come back. This team's going to look different because of lineup protection, all these different things. And since he's been back, he's been, like, I don't know, like one of their worst hitters.
No, and I wish I had a simple explanation for you, and I really don't, because his timing has just been completely out of sorts at the plate. Yeah. We are, you know, just seeing him not getting, well, getting his pitch, but not getting to it with his barrel. And it's funny how much we went from Teoscar Hernandez being like a quad A outfielder, questions about his future in MLB, to just a guy that we relied upon as a silver slugger year in and year out. Like, this has all happened over the course of the last 3 to 4 years. It's, his career has been remarkable. And that production was, like, so quiet but so steady the last couple of years. And we are just not seeing it right now from him in 2022. And I'm as confounded by it as you are. I'm not seeing the max exit velo up where it needs to be. I mean, this has been like a 113, 114, 115, 116 guy over the last couple of years. And Teoscar Hernandez's hardest hit ball in play this year is 109. Like, that's a hard hit ball, but this is a guy who we know can hit the ball a lot harder when his swing is right and when his timing is right and when he's getting the barrel to the ball. So it's mysterious to me. I don't know if it's health related. I don't know if it's a mechanical issue, if there's a tweak to be made here. Obviously he missed time with that oblique and came back. You wonder if that's still bothering him. I mean, there's a lot of things that could be at play here, but absolutely Teoscar Hernandez's struggles are just confounding right now.
Well, that, like, you just kind of answered it, that you don't know whether it's the oblique thing, but okay, here's what I know about oblique injuries, because they only happen in baseball, is whenever they happen, people go, they tend to linger. They tend to linger. So that's all I can think of right now is when I watch this guy, I'm thinking, all right, when I hear Arden say that the exit velocity is down and he looks like, yeah, a guy whose timing is off, I can't help but feel a little bit like, okay, well, maybe if you have less power and you're not swinging the way you used to, it's because you're trying to make an adjustment to your swing. Like, is there any fear for you that this guy saw the way that the team was struggling and the team saw, like, the way that he was struggling? Like, I don't know how you measure an oblique injury as a doctor. Like, it feels to me like a lot of it is pain tolerance, that there is a decent chance anyways that this guy rushed back.
Yeah, I mean, obliques are tough for hitters like Teoscar, who, like, really, like, grip it and rip it, like, watch his swing, right? There's a lot of torque there.
Exactly.
For a lot of these Blue Jays hitters, right? George Springer's the same way. Bo Bichette is the same way. So some of those abdominal muscles are, like, so important just for transferring power from the ground through your legs into your bat and through the ball eventually. So, yeah, I don't know if that's still bothering him. I mean, I would imagine it's not something that just goes away at the snap of the fingers. We know how professional athletes are. Like, you never really 100% get over an injury in season. You get it to 60, 70, 80% where the pain tolerance makes sense and where you can play with it and compete with it and still produce. or at least feel like you can produce at the highest level, and you go out there and you strap them up and you try to help your team. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to speculate whether he's, still feeling the after effects of that, but obviously only he knows that for sure.
Well, not all oblique injuries are created equal. So Teoscar is struggling with his a little bit. A guy who's back from his and does not seem to be any worse for the wear is Danny Jansen, our new bat-first back catcher. He starts – I got to stop saying back catcher. The baseball hardcores get mad when I say back catcher. It's just what it is in my head. It sounds better.
Honestly, it does sound weird. Every time you say it,
it sounds better as a three-syllable word than a two-syllable word to me.
You sound like you're like this old-timey guy where you're like, the back catcher? I'm like, I don't get it. Like, it's weird.
Yeah. I'm trying to do the old Yankee Stadium speaker and everything. I do it a lot, and I got to stop. So Danny Jansen, though, he is back. He is catching. He is also raking. He's got a 250 WRC plus and a tiny sample so far. Hits two home runs again last night. I would say normally maybe this is just a blip. Maybe it's just small sample. But, Arden, we saw Danny Jansen really turn a corner late last year with his ability to drive the ball to his pull side. Is this just the continuation of this? Obviously, he's not going to slug 900 for the year. But Danny Jansen looks like a fundamentally better hitter over the last, 4 months of actual action.
Yeah, you can go back to 2021. He had six homers over his final 21 games of that season when he came back from that hamstring issue. And like, it's interesting. It's such a great example of just how important mentality is to hitting and how much of hitting really is mental. Like, I think that's the biggest change Danny Jansen made. That's what he'll tell you, at least, is that he just stopped trying to go the other way. It's kind of funny, right? Because we've, throughout these, these slumps for the Blue Jays across the team, we've all said, "Oh, just shoot pitches the other way. You got to change your approach. You got to use all fields." Yeah, Danny Jansen's like, "Nah, I'm just going to use left. I'm just going to try to pull everything. I'm going to do exactly what everyone says the problem is," and it's working for him. And I think that throughout 2021, a lot of 2020, he felt there was a lot of things clouding his head when he was at the plate. He was thinking about a lot of these mechanical things he was trying to do to use all fields and to go the other way and to beat shifts. And I think the ball just got on him a little bit faster because of all those things he was thinking. And once he cleared his head, it was just focused in on like, hey, I'm a really strong pull hitter. I'm just going to do what I'm really strong at. I think that just freed him up a lot, and that goes into like how you prepare for a game as well. Danny Jansen was a guy who was doing like 15 different drills pregame just to try to get his mechanics right, to try to shoot balls the other way. Now he really just focuses in on like two or three drills that are going to allow him to tap into that pull power. We're seeing it show up in games. I mean, he has embraced what he does best, and he has freed himself up in a lot of ways, I think. And, it's cool to see for a young guy who obviously, like, his bat got him to the majors. He wasn't a defense-first guy. We forget about that. But his bat got him to the show, and then obviously went through his struggles through his first couple of years, and now he's looking like the old guy again, and that's huge for the Blue Jays.
And sometimes your concern is that a guy starts selling out for pull side power and maybe it opens up a hole in his swing or he gets a little too aggressive or whatever. But all of Jansen's discipline indicators are in the right direction. He's barely swinging and missing. A good management of the zone. What's a strike? What's not a strike? Can you make contact on the pitches you do swing at? So really encouraging there. Now, the Jays roster, for the first time in forever, only has two catchers on it. And I'm curious, Arden, as to say... Obviously, it's too early for this, but say Thursday's
win. I know where you're going with this. Come on, yes. Yes, Blake, yes. Do the thing.
Are you think I'm going Moreno?
Yes, I do.
So Moreno is, he started hot at AAA. He cooled off a little bit, and everyone's saying the plate appearances have been better. They've been moving in the right direction. Is there a version of this team where they have three catchers on the roster and all three are getting enough playing time between catcher and DH? Because Kirk's defense has improved, yes, but you still probably in a must-win situation. You have him in the DH slot, Jansen catching. Is there a spot for Moreno with Jansen and Kirk playing as well as they are?
I think you could definitely do it. You could definitely find playing time for all three. Is it the most optimal thing for Moreno's development? No. But maybe he's shown you enough, and maybe you've seen what you need to see from him, and you think that he can help you at the big league level. Coming into the year, I thought, like, June, July was pretty much the target for Moreno. It was a good time. And looking at the calendar, it's just about June. So I think that's absolutely a move the Blue Jays could consider making. You think about it, like, nobody catches every day, right? So you can absolutely have that cycle of different guys behind the plate. You don't have a full-time DH, so that spot is always open for you if you want to get another bat, like Kirk's bat there more often, if there are matchups that you like for Jansen offensively, but you're not going to have him behind the plate on a given day. And, you know, the other thing is Gabriel Moreno can play the infield too if you need him to. And Matt Chapman's not a guy who takes a lot of days off. And I don't know that he's even had one to this point this year, but if you wanted to give him a day off at some point or a DH day, Moreno can play third, and he can be like that Russ Martin type who is a catcher most of the time. But that'll get Blake going, that right? A catcher most of the time, but sometimes a third baseman and a DH as well. So we've seen it. The Blue Jays like having that third catcher for one reason or another. They don't mind that roster construction. We've seen them carry it through this 26-man roster phase. It wasn't just the 28-man roster. We've seen them continue it. So I think it's absolutely something they could consider.
Yeah, I love this line of thinking. I'm so glad Blake brought it up. Because, baseball is such a patient sport, and especially when it comes to prospects. But everyone's sort of looked at this and gone, well, how is the offense going to improve? How is the offense going to start to get better right now? And, obviously there's some positive regression, and everyone's talked about it, right? Like, you're not going to hit sub-200 with runners in scoring position all season. Like, it's just not going to happen. Vladdy's going to get better. Teoscar's not this guy. Blah, 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 blah. Go on down the line. But I'm kind of over how important Raimel Tapia is to this team. Like, how it's like every game I see Raimel Tapia, and if I don't see him, then it's Bradley Zimmer. And I know that, like, it doesn't seem like Moreno's going to play in the outfield, but I'm like, how hard is it to teach this guy to just play one game and left? Or how much worse could it be if he gets a day as a DH? Like, I don't know. I guess my bigger question is, like, I love the way that Kirk has taken a step as a defensive catcher. He's not the greatest of all time, but I am pretty surprised at how confident I feel with him back there. Like, the DH thing between him and Danny Jansen, those guys are both raking. But, I do wonder, like, what the versatility would be like when it comes to trying Moreno at different spots, knowing that they have those two guys going the way that they're going behind the plate.
Yeah, I think that asking Gabriel Moreno to play the outfield for the first time in his life at the big league level is probably a lot. That's probably a lot to put on the young guy. But
I saw Chris Colabello do it in a big spot. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like,
I saw Adam Lind do it. Yeah. We've seen a lot of interesting names out in left field for sure. And I would hope Blue Jays have a better, deeper roster now where they aren't forced to do those things.
Dude, Raimel Tapia can't throw a baseball. So, like, it can't get much worse than that. Like, honest to God, like, it's crazy to watch a professional baseball player who cannot throw a baseball, like, in a straight line from the outfield.
What's interesting about Kirk v. Moreno is that Moreno, I would say, is probably ahead of Kirk just in terms of athletic ability behind the plate, blocking balls, receive. Well, Kirk's such a good receiver. I don't know about that. Certainly throwing to the bases. Like, Moreno's got an absolute cannon, and his pop times are elite. So, like, he absolutely has better tools behind the plate, I would say. But Kirk is going to be ahead of Moreno in terms of game calling and in terms of not letting a game speed up on him and working with a starting pitcher and following a game plan and knowing what to go to, reading swings and making good pitch selections. And, like, look, it's funny. I was talking to Zach Collins about it before he was sent down, and just about being a young catcher at the big league level and what the hardest part is. And he was telling me, like, look, it's you come into a veteran pitching staff and you're some kid just up from AAA, and you got to tell, like, a Kevin Gausman or a Jose Barrios or Hyunjin Ryu, somebody who has a really good idea of what they want to do, hey, this is the pitch. Like, this is what you're going to throw. It's hard to gain that confidence from veteran pitchers. And the Blue Jays have a very veteran starting rotation outside of Alec Manoah. So I would be really interested just to see, like, how that game calling and preparation and just all those, you know, little intricacies of managing a game from behind the plate, how those would sort of flourish with Moreno, like how those would show up at the big league level. I don't know. I'm like you guys. I want to see it. I think it would be cool because I like seeing interesting things happen. And I think that as the season continues, as Moreno's bat, which is big league ready now, let's be honest, but as it continues to show itself at the AAA level, something the Blue Jays are going to have to consider.
It's this is why we get along so well, Arden. We both like cool things. That's mm-hmm. pretty much it. I look at the roster construction too, and it's like you're never gonna get a manager who wants to, like, the Jays roster construction right now has a catcher, an infielder, and an outfielder on the bench. Like, asking a manager to go with less than that for flexibility and versatility is probably asking too much. But Bradley Zimmer is coming off like he just threatened a record and has the major league high for most consecutive appearances without actually being trusted to get a plate appearance. He's basically just the, hey, this game's out of hand, let's get Springer a breather guy. Vinny Capra, I still don't even know what he would look like at the plate. I don't think he's played in a week. So yeah, maybe those guys are in the mix.
Every time he gets he plays, I go, Vinny Capra's on this team? Like, I never believe it. It's also still now the most awkward pull I've seen in a baseball game, where he went out to play the field and they were like, no, that's enough. Come back to the dugout, kid. Like, it's tough. It's a tough look for old Cap.
Hasn't had a plate appearance in 12 days. So in terms of, you know, what does this look like depth-wise and versatility-wise? Well, they're not using Zimmer and Capper anyway. They're basically running 10 guys out there. So I don't think it would be that hard. You also have the option to go down a pitcher. Arden, what do you, before we let you go, thing you're most looking forward to this weekend with that Angels series? Vlad versus Shohei, Vlad versus Trout. What are you looking at here? What stands out most?
Oh, just watching Shohei, for sure. We take it for granted that Babe Ruth walks among us, and it's just, like, normalized that the things that Shohei Ohtani does. Like, it's once-in-a-lifetime sort of stuff, what Shohei Ohtani's doing. Like, he's absolutely, any time that you are able to watch a Shohei Ohtani start, you have to watch it, because he is just so next level, and he might, as you know, he might hit a couple bombs as well. So, like, he's mystical. He's a unicorn. It's unbelievable what he's doing. We shouldn't get so desensitized to it, the fact that, like, this guy exists and is doing it. Like, what was the question for so long? Was, can he do both? Is he going to hold up? Well, he is doing both. He is elite at both, and he is holding up. So we absolutely need to, you know, appreciate that and enjoy watching him play ball. So that's what I'm most looking forward to.
And, oh, by the way, Mike Trout has, like, a 4,000 WRC plus, too. So the Angels are finally good. They have both those guys healthy. Arden Zwelling, thanks so much for taking the time today, man. Enjoy that series this weekend.
Yeah, no worries. That's when you know the sample size on a season is big enough, by the way, when Mike Trout's leading MLT in WRC plus. That's when you know. And he is. So we've got a big enough sample now. It's not early anymore, guys.
I made the comment earlier that if your metric doesn't have Patrice Bergeron at the top in the NHL or Chris Paul near the top in NBA, that you need to relook at your metric, and you're right. If Mike Trout's not at the top, the sample's too small or your metric's flawed. Arden Zwelling, thanks so much, buddy.
Be well. Take it easy.
Arden Zwelling, Blue Jays columnist, co-host of the Athletics podcast, and that insider has been brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit DonValleyNorthLexus.com. JD, the way you describe watching Rymel Tapia now reminds me very much of the scene in Good Will Hunting where Ben Affleck tells Matt Damon, look, the best part of my day every day is I'm going to pull up to your door to pick you up and you just won't answer. Yeah. The best part of JD's day every day is when the Jays tweet the lineup card out and he gets to think for a split second that maybe Tapia and Zimmer aren't on it.
No, but that's the point, is that, like, there is never a day where I hope Tapia is not in the lineup because the option is Bradley Zimmer is in. Like, that's what I'm...
Well, you do have one lineup configuration with neither of those guys, and it's a Gurriel, Springer, Teoscar day with both catchers in.
Yeah, which is, to me, great. Much better. Tapia was decent at the dish yesterday again, and honestly, he's been a little bit better lately. But, like, it's the relative thing, right, where you go, hey, he's been better lately. Is his OPS over 600 yet? No. He's got incredible speed in the outfield, but he doesn't seem to have great instincts in the outfield. But the thing that bothers me probably more than anything right now is, like, the power of his arm. I don't know if he has dead arm. Was he always like this? I'm serious. Like, I don't know if it's actually, like, an injury or if he just simply cannot throw. But dude is a liability out there from a – like, the one thing you're supposed to have as an outfielder is a cannon for an arm. It's what's so funny is, like, guys that get put in corner outfield spots, it's usually like, hey, man, you can't really kill us here because – we don't trust you. The ball's going to go over your head and, like, don't kill us out here. You're supposed to have a cannon for an arm. Jose Bautista, remember? Hey, big arm, corner outfield spot. Do you remember Jose Bautista ever making, like, a great defensive play? No, it was his arm. Lourdes Gurriel Jr., we talk about it. Like, he got nominated for a Golden Glove.
He got nominated for a Gold Glove by rope-a-doping people into taking bases they shouldn't and then throwing them out.
Arm.
By the way, Tapia has 17 career outfield assists.
Wow. So dead arm.
But that's career. Gurriel had 12 last year.
Okay, yeah.
In 115 games.
Yeah,
so
either way.
So Tapia does not, like, obviously an arm is a tough thing to, like, get a rating on because you
no but it's not in. When you can
do,
it's extreme.
Do guys take the extra base and stuff like that? He's been worth minus five runs in his career based on outfield arm runs above average from UZR, so that's not the best thing, but it at least backs up the eye test that he's been a big negative from the arm perspective.
No, dude, it's one of those things that you can only usually tell with the extremes. Like, you can tell if someone has a massive arm when it's like Ichiro, and you go, holy cow, can you believe that that guy just threw that baseball there? He had that outfield assist. You can tell when it's Vladimir Guerrero Sr. Lourdes Gurriel Jr. does have a cannon for an arm, right? You can tell when it's a third baseman, it's Matt Chapman, where it's like, oh my God, that hums different than the other third baseman on the other side. And Tapia is that extreme with the opposite, where it's like, dude, his arm strength is brutal for a Major League Baseball player. It actually kind of reminds me a little bit of when the Jays had Curtis Granderson here for that little bit. It was at the end of his career where it went like, boy, you feel like he can't make all the throws. Anyway, I'm not trying to hammer the guy. It's just that this is – my point is not that you can't have a rival Tapia. Like, the theory of Tapia is fine, that you have a lefty bat who's a high-contact guy that can run the bases. It's just that – I didn't expect him to be an everyday baseball player, right? I'll never forget, one of our guests called him the Jays' fifth outfielder, and I was counting on my fingers, and I went, what? And it's like, I think that there was some expectation that's what he was supposed to be, is like a platoon utility guy. Charlie does use bad players too often. It's one of my biggest criticisms of him, is that he's like a big, I got to get everybody in the lineup, which tells you how bad Capra is, that he doesn't even ever play him. Like, that's just, if you can't play under Charlie, you're bad, buddy. You're bad. Bradley Zimmer gets in there every once in a while. You're bad. But this is my thing with Gabriel Moreno, is at what point do you just try to get a little creative? Like, honestly, I know that development for a player like that, is it really that bad for his development if the Bisons go, hey, Gabriel Moreno, we're going to play you three games in a row in the outfield. We're going to play you in left field and just see what this looks like. I know that ideally he would come in and he would be a DH, and you'd have one of the catchers go, or it's a way of deploying the three catchers where one of them's continuously getting rest. But I don't need him to be the catcher on this team. Like, that's the dead last thing I need right now. I trust both guys defensively. Both guys are going with the pitching staff right now. Like, it's a veteran staff that's the best in baseball. I really don't need a rookie catcher stepping in there and having to all of a sudden learn these guys and be with these guys. Like, this is an all-in season. I don't want Gabriel Moreno behind the plate. I also don't want him taking reps from Matt Chapman when every single ground ball that goes to Matt Chapman, I go, oh, sweet, out. Like, oh, yes, out. Like, I don't want Matt Chapman off days. So, yeah, all right, DH is fine, but they obviously need that DH spot for getting Springer off his feet, whatever. Like, there's got to be one place that this guy can play other than just third base or catcher, which is the two defensive spots that, like, you least want him at on this baseball team. So I don't know. It sounds so dumb to baseball people when you ask it, but I am kind of curious whether or not they're going to get a little bit flexible in terms of looking at how they can deploy Gabriel Moreno other than in the two places that he's used to playing.
Yeah, it's something to watch because he's going to be knocking on the door, right? Like, I put his stats in the chat earlier, and he's rounded out he's got a 130 WRC plus, so he's hitting about 30% better than the average AAA player, and he's a little young for that level as well, which is a really good indicator. Like, we always want to try to control for player age at a certain level, and he just turned 22, so the athleticism's there. But the biggest thing is, early in the year, he was hitting the ball a lot, but his plate discipline stuff is, I mean, the best indicators we have of your process at the dish weren't that great. And suddenly now he's walking in 8% of his plate appearances and striking out in fewer than 20%. That shows kind of an advanced approach. His OBP is pushing up against 400. That Bisons team, actually, if the Jays continue struggling with getting guys on base, that team is an OBP monster, including Kevin Biggio, who, shocker, is walking in like 30% of his plate appearances when he faces bad pitchers. But there are a couple guys down there
who can't throw strikes will struggle with Kevin Biggio. Major League Baseball players who can throw strikes, they're getting them out.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is there are guys down there who could potentially help, and maybe you don't like the Moreno thing. Maybe you do look at a Kevin Biggio replacing a Vinny Capra at some point. Maybe you even look at, hey, Jordan Groshans is playing pretty well down there, and I know that he's been, you know, every Jays fan throws him in every possible trade scenario because this system has a glut of middle infielder types without a true position. But anyway, if you don't trust Vinny Capra for a week at a time and you have a couple of interesting prospects hitting the ball off the cover off the ball at AAA, you're going to have these kind of conversations, especially in a win now season where, yes, long-term development still matters because you need these guys for the extended life of this core, but also you need wins right now. Let's take a break. Let's get a big win and talk to Cassie Campbell-Pascal after the break. We'll go through the old Battle of Alberta again and talk a little bit more PWHPA. That's next with Cassie Campbell-Pascal on the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, coming off another electric Battle of Alberta game last night. Someone that knows all too well the rivalry between those teams. Let's talk to Cassie Campbell-Pascal, Canada Women's National Team, two-time Olympic gold medalist, current Sportsnet and ESPN analyst. Good morning, Cassie.
How's it going?
Oh, we're good. We're staying up late, and it's worthwhile when you get to watch the Battle of Alberta, the Flames, Oilers. It's just every game seems like something exciting is happening. What's been the best part of the series for you, being able to be that up close and personal and covering it?
Well, actually, I'm not covering it. I get to be a fan this year. So I actually asked Sportsnet and ESPN for the playoffs off. So that's been really fun, and getting a little bit of rest after what was a busy year with the women's Olympic team and the two networks. And so I'm kind of getting to be a fan and supporting my family. My husband works for the Calgary Flames, and also his AHL team is doing really well as well. So it's nice to be able to be home and support the family. And it's been a crazy series to watch. I can tell you every game has been different, and it seems like at any moment, you know, even in game three when the Flames were down, you'd think they'd come back, just the way the scoring had kind of gone earlier in the series. And but it's been you know, all goalies have played at some point. It's been physical. Mm-hmm. There's been chirping. You know, we're watching Connor McDavid play arguably the best hockey of his career, and you know, that's been a fun thing, and so there's lots happening in this series.
Okay, can we just have to start with Connor McDavid, though, because this is just, like, we've all seen him play, and we all know how special he is and spectacular he is, but this has been a whole other thing that we continue to reference on our show. It, like, the only thing it reminds me of is, like, comparisons are NBA superstars, where I go, okay, this actually reminds me more of Shaquille O'Neal than it does of Sidney Crosby. I'm curious, you know, what you've been thinking about when you've been watching him play and how difficult it is for the Flames when he's presenting this challenge on a night-in, night-out basis.
You know, I have to be honest with you guys and say that I think it's his defense. And I know that sounds crazy because he's putting up these unbelievable numbers, but I just think he's playing his best defensive hockey of his career, and that is allowing him to be even more offensive, which you think, how can that happen? He's been, you know, arguably the most talented player offensively to play in the NHL in a long time. But I just think his commitment to defense, I think, you know, Dave Manson and the coaching change, you know, Dave Manson in particular coming in, I think has really done a good job on their team defense. But I think it's someone that Connor McDavid has bought into, what he's selling. And, you know, he's slowed himself down in the defensive zone. He's made that a huge priority. And I think that's a big reason why he's playing some of his best hockey. And, you know, I have a little bit of a theory, too, that, you know, the NHLPA poll came out and Sidney Crosby was voted by the players as the most complete player. And, you know, when you look at these superstars, they are uber competitive. They see these things and they're kind of like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, I'm the best player. And I really think that Connor has taken that to heart. And I know in the off season last summer, defensive part of his game was a huge priority for him. And so it should have been. And honestly, that's why I think we're seeing what we're seeing. I just think his game has gotten to a more complete level We all have always known what he can do with the puck. There was no one on the offensive side of the game. You know, Matthews, maybe you could say, is the better goal scorer of the two, but there's no one who does what Connor McDavid does and at the speed that he does. And then to add the defensive side to his game, I think it's a big part of his success right now and his team's success.
We're obviously big Matthews fans here. We appreciate everything that he does. I agree with you that we can compare them as goal scorers, but after watching McDavid in this postseason, I have decided as a host in Toronto that I will stop comparing the two players. Like, I will do my best to do it because, yeah, it's just a different thing that McDavid's able to do night in, night out. And again, like, the carrying of his team has been spectacular. I'm glad that you brought up his defensive side. So, what went through your mind when you saw that goal go in against Mike Smith?
You know, I think Mike Smith, honestly, he took his eye off the puck for a second. And like, you know, he kind of looked down at his feet and, you know, fatigue and all these things, you know, are setting in at this point in the playoffs for sure. And he literally took his eyes off the puck for 1 second and it cost him. And you know, you see the replays and it was one of those seeing eye shots. And you know, you look at back at the first Oilers goal that was a bit of a gaffe by Jacob Markstrom, and it was a bad bounce, an unlucky bounce in that regard. And so it was sort of like the hockey guard evening things up and, you know, making this third period and the ending of the game even more exciting than it already was. And, you know, he just literally, he took his eyes off the puck for a second. And as a goaltender, and I've never played goalie, so I don't really know, but I think that's just killer, right? You lose sight of it for a split second, and all of a sudden it's in the back of your net. And a heads-up play by Anderson. He put, you know, he shot that with a purpose and, you know, recognized that moment in a split second and you know, maybe got lucky with the shot, but nonetheless put it on net and put it on net with a purpose.
So if you're looking forward to what the Calgary Flames might need to do to get the series a little bit closer tomorrow night, it seems like all the best players have been on Edmonton, whether it's Evander Kane having two natural hat tricks so far in the playoffs, obviously McDavid, Drysdale, and even our guy, Zach Hyman. So what do you need from the Calgary Flames stars? One of their best lines has been arguably someone that has been, you know, a little bit underrated this series so far, or this year. What do you need from them come tomorrow night?
Well, I think you need a little bit more from everyone. You know, I'll be honest and fully say that, you know, last night I thought the Flames played arguably their best game of the playoffs. You know, even watching them in Dallas, play against Dallas, I still don't think we've seen their best team game. And that's the strength of the Flames. You know, you can talk about their top line and how good they've been, and they were excellent in the regular season. And, you know, they finished off that Dallas series, you know, on a high note. But this is a team that really has to win by committee. You know, they have to get more depth scoring. They have to get scoring from their back end. They need Markstrom to be great. You know, but again, this is a moment where you look at your top guys and you look at McDavid, you look at Dreisaitl, you look at Kane, you look at Hyman, and you look at Ryan Nugent-Hopkins last night. That was a huge game from him. You know, they're starting to get everyone firing on all cylinders, and, you know, the Flames need to counter that. They, you know, it has to be obviously from their top guys, but I think they need more from everyone on the offensive side of the game. And, you know, that's how they've been so successful all year.
Yeah, they're a balanced team, but that line was arguably the best in hockey this season. Are you seeing them play the same way? Like, what has changed? Because, like, the last couple of games, they haven't hit the score sheet, and it's been a lot of dashes.
Yeah, you know, I just think it's the Oilers' commitment. You know, when you're getting a playoff series and you're playing each other, you know, back and forth and every other night, you know, the commitment to trying to shut them down, it's been really, really good. You know, they're, again, other than that first game, they're probably playing their best defensive hockey of the season. So, you know, it's been a commitment. Mike Smith has been excellent. You know, he's playing some of his best hockey of his career and extra motivated because, of course, the Flames didn't sign him and chose to sign Jacob Markstrom. And, you know, he's getting older in his career, so, you know, wanting to win a cup and recognizing that, you know, the chances aren't going to come as often as they once did. And, but you need more. You need more from Matthew Tkachuk. I think he could be a lot more physical and create more havoc down low. You need Lindholm to, you know, he's kind of known to get into that, you know, sweet spot in that slot area, but he's got to mix things up. You know, people read that and they cover that, and you got to find different ways to score. And, you know, I think one of the things that made Johnny Gaudreau, you know, have one of his best seasons of his career was his ability as a smaller guy to get to the middle of the ice. And, you know, that was one thing I think Daryl Sutter brought out of him. And, you know, he's been a little bit perimeter. You know, you watch the last game, he's not getting to the middle of the ice as much as he would. And part of that is, you know, being one of those players that's being targeted and they're going to be physical on you. But I think he has to get back to creating more through the middle of the ice and opening up some space for his line mates. And, you know, I think all three of them just need to be better in their own subtle little ways.
I hope that ends up happening because I want more games of this. I don't want this to be over, but you mentioned, you know, your stakes in this, and it's probably a very different asking you because I think about you as someone who's like doesn't feel like the nerves. But what do you think it's like what is it like in Calgary right now? Because I just feel I actually empathize with the fans of both sides because it's so intense and you feel it watching these games. You feel it when you see those crowds. But yeah, now it's an elimination game and the reality has to be setting in for people in Calgary like, oh my God, they might have these bragging rights over us forever. What is the tone in the city?
I think the tone is like, why aren't they playing well? What's happening? Yeah. You know, I don't want to say the Battle of Alberta is like religion, but you know when you see a soccer game in Europe, and it's about religion sometimes, you know, and that's I'm really glad that everyone out east is getting an opportunity to watch this Battle of Alberta because I live it. You live it in every aspect of your life, you know. Last year, Edmonton Oilers found out that my husband works for the Calgary Flames, so I hear about it all the time, and it's just. You know, it's just this kind of, and again, I hate to use the word religion, but it is. It's like in economics, in business, in any kind of government thing, it's like Calgary versus Edmonton. Every aspect of life is Calgary versus Edmonton. And then you add hockey, the number one sport that everyone loves. You know, it's so intense. And I think here in Calgary, people are just kind of like, you know, why aren't they playing well? And why aren't we seeing what we saw in the regular season? Well, it's the playoffs, you know, and Edmonton wants to win too. But it is, it's fierce. You know, if you're walking down the street in Edmonton, like I did the first two games, Edmonton, LA, for ESPN, and like people know that I live in Calgary. So they're just giving it to me, you know, and it's just, it's more than just hockey, but because it's hockey, it's even more. And that's really the best way I can put it. It is an intense rivalry and, it's fierce in all aspects of life.
It's wild. And I think that the soccer comparison is the perfect one because when you're watching these games, that's how it feels. Is when you're watching a regional rivalry in soccer where you know that this like fallout is going to like that it's going to be remembered forever and ever and ever and it's going to be referenced forever and ever and ever. That's what this is. And so that's why I really hope that Calgary's top players and Markstrom, like these guys can level out a little bit and extend this series. Because yeah, I would hate for such a good season to be kind of lost to just, wow, the disappointment of this postseason and have that be remembered in that way. I hope somehow, some way we end up at least getting seven games. Cassie, thanks so much as always for making time for our show. We very much appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Have a great day.
Take care. Cassie Campbell-Pascal, who in Calgary has those stakes. And I don't disagree with her. And I think that's why we're all loving this is like, and this is why stakes matter. And this is why players caring matters. And this is why all of it matters is like, I don't want to get too preachy about some of these things because, like, I can very much get emotional about sports and the power of sports and all these different things. And I just look at those people in those crowds, those fans that are in the seats, but also the ones that are crowded around their arenas and in their versions of their town squares, right? The Red Miles and the Oilers fans and the reaction of Calgary fans when that thing goes in the net and just, like, the bonds that creates. And just as a casual viewers, like every one of us wants to just be a part of it. How many people are on the East Coast that are listening to this right now that did stay up late to watch that game? And it's because stakes. It's like they're not appreciably better hockey teams than Colorado and St. Louis. And Colorado and St. Louis are hating each other right now, too. You're getting everything from that. Superstar players, you know, real hate amongst each other, known characters. It's big. But that regional rivalry, like that's something that we just, we miss so much right now in sports in North America, I think, is like rivalries in general. Like we've sort of lost them, right? It's just not the same anymore. There's only a couple that really seem to matter, and this is just one of them. And this is the one in hockey. And it's like even Leafs-Habs, we tried to manufacture, it's not really a thing. Leafs-Sens used to be, but it completely lost its momentum because neither team was good for so long. And also, there's just such a discrepancy in little brother, big brother in that one that it almost feels like bullying when the Leafs are good and the Sens are bad. And when the Sens are good and the Leafs are bad, it's kind of a who cares because there's only, you know, there's so few Sens fans compared to Leafs fans. This is just such a good one. This is just exactly what hockey needed, and that's why I'm terrified we're only going to get five games of it. Like, please not just five games of it. Find a way, Calgary. Find a way to continue to let everybody else have a taste, because I think it's a reminder of just, like, why part of the reminders of why we love sports so much or when sports can be at their best, and it's when there is stakes. Stakes beyond just a championship or the things we invent. Like, this is real stakes that run through communities.
I know we ripped on the NHL playoff format before because of where the Leafs ended up.
But this was the whole design.
That's exactly where I'm going with this, is that, hey, now there is some rivalries actually being formed that get a chance to play in the playoffs. And I think that maybe we're a little bit biased because obviously the Leafs getting to play the Tampa Bay Lightning sucked. You know, we wanted them to play longer into the playoffs and not play the team that's back-to-back Stanley Cup. But if you take your Toronto-centric view out of that, we've seen some really great matchups, and I think this is one of them. So, like, there's a little bit of a win for the NHL playoff format, maybe not on the side that we cover as regularly, but this has been so special. It's something that we want to see. I would love to see this every single year. You know, it's pretty incredible, and you might see a McDavid-McKinnon playoff series next. Yeah. Like, that is an incredible rivalry. You might see a Shesterkin-Vasilevsky next round, which would be a huge battle between two goaltenders. So there are some really good things happening. Obviously, we wanted to see the Leafs make it a little longer, but if you take the little homer side out of it, maybe there are some good things about this playoff format.
No, you lost me. You defending this playoff format, you lost me. The whole thing for this is to create the regional rivalries between teams, and you're right, like that's supposed to be the product of it. But this required those two teams to both get out of the first round to face each other. And, like, yeah, anytime you get to a conference finals, you better have some compelling figures to sell. Maybe not McKinnon, McDavid, but it's like, yeah, by the time we get there, I better have some stars. Like, I better not get into a conference finals matchup where you got to sell
Dallas
me again
stars.
On those Dallas Stars that we got from a couple years ago, which was also that same playoff format, right? Historically, this has been pretty bad, and it hasn't really worked out for the NHL, but if they
maybe we were lucky this time.
we did get lucky that these two teams were, but it's not even like the format, it's that these two teams are good at the same time. Like that we're not just watching crappy teams, we're watching really good teams play each other, and that's why the stakes are high. Is because both teams feel like if they can get beyond this, they can win. This isn't some like fluky crappy first round matchup. Like that was part of the juice that was lost in the Montreal-Toronto thing. Like Montreal got to play, spoiler, and I know they went to a Stanley Cup final, so it feels weird, but it's like no one thought Montreal could win. Like everybody knew that eventually Montreal would run into a team where they got exposed last year, and it happened. It just so happened to be in the Stanley Cup finals. And like with this one, Connor McDavid's playing well enough where his team could win. Calgary's a good enough team where if they can rebound and find form, like they could win. They're as good a team as anybody. Like the stakes of not only beating each other, but being able to go win a Stanley Cup and having that kind of like urgency with it, potentially losing Johnny Gaudreau from the Flames, losing another opportunity cost of a year of McDavid in his prime like this, like those are things that you can't miss out on. The stakes are incredible. I can't wait for more. Again, Thursday night, boy oh boy. And we need another win too so that we get to Saturday night. We need a hockey night in Canada where we all get to stay up late, nobody cares, and we get to sleep in the next day and watch this Flames series. We're back tomorrow after more sleep. No Jays tonight, no Battle of Alberta. Watch whatever you want. It's the Fan Morning Show. JD Blake and Ayler, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.